The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 20th, 2015 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Republicans tell Iran nuclear deal won't last. What happened? The bitter political debate over a potential nuclear deal with Iran sharply escalated this week when 47 Republican senators signed an open letter warning Iran's leaders that any agreement made without congressional approval could be reversed with the stroke of a pen by the next president. The letter advised the leadership in Tehran that it may not fully understand America's constitutional system, and that while President Obama would leave the White House in January 2017, Republican senators would remain in office well beyond then, perhaps decades. Written by freshman Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, the letter was signed by the entire GOP Senate leadership and was supported by 10 of the party's leading 2016 presidential candidates. Seven of the 54 Republican senators refused to put their name on it. President Obama said Republican senators and hardline mullahs in Tehran made for an unusual coalition, while Maine Independent Senator Angus King likened the letter to Congress telling the Soviet Union during the Cuban Missile Crisis, "Don't worry about that guy Kennedy. He doesn't speak for the country." Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, dismissed the letter as a propaganda ploy, arguing that the U.S. would violate international law if it abrogated an agreement Iran was negotiating with a total of six nations. Despite the furor, negotiators said they remained confident that a framework deal, which would keep Iran's breakout time to develop nuclear weapons at a year in exchange for sanctions relief, would be reached before the March 24th deadline. What the editorial said: "There's only one word to describe Cotton and his cronies," said the New York Daily News. "Traitors. They're right to oppose the nuclear deal as it stands, but cutting the legs out from under America's commander-in-chief at this delicate stage of negotiations is an embarrassment to the Senate and to the nation. This petulant, condescending stunt will probably backfire. Now even pro-Israel Democrats will be unlikely to support the GOP's attempt to pass legislation requiring an Iran deal to be approved by Congress." "Obama partly brought this on himself," said the Wall Street Journal. "He froze out Congress and promised to veto any attempt to allow lawmakers a vote on the deal. Even so, Republicans have taken their eye off the ball. With the deadline for a framework agreement fast approaching, they should be putting all their energy into convincing Americans that the proposed deal is a security blunder that will lead to a nuclear-armed Iran." Giving Obama a meaningless letter to shoot at detracts from that debate. What the columnist said: "Dissent from Obama is not treason. It's called democracy," said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Democrats, including Obama, certainly weren't reluctant to criticize President George W. Bush's foreign policy or reverse it when they took power. "The letter will put Iran on notice that our Constitution requires international deals to be ratified by Congress and that a deal approved solely by one president has no lasting legitimacy. One-man rule may make sense in Tehran, but not here. Republicans have shot themselves in the foot, said Mark Champion in BloombergView.com. Throughout these prolonged negotiations, the GOP has pushed for stronger sanctions. But if the nuclear deal falls through, Tehran can justifiably blame Washington, and Europe will have a good excuse to drop its sanctions. With neither a deal nor sanctions in place, the Iranians would inevitably go back to building a nuclear weapon. And the only way the U.S. could stop them then would be with a bombing mission likely to escalate into a full-scale war. What were those 47 senators thinking? Are they really eager for another war? Beyond these negotiations, the effects of our national security may well be profound and lasting, said Leslie Gelb in thedailybeast.com. Republicans have essentially told every nation in the world, friend and enemy, that America is now so bitterly divided that our president no longer speaks for the country abroad. The GOP has also opened the door to similar partisan interventions by Congress into a future president's foreign policy. At some point, the Republicans will reap what they have sown. Our controversy of the week: Hillary, why Democrats are suddenly nervous. Sorry, Democrats, but this story isn't going away, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. At an extremely awkward press conference this week, presumptive Democratic 2016 presidential nominee Hillary Clinton explained that as Secretary of State, she used only a private email account routed through a secure server in her Chappaqua, New York basement as a matter of simple convenience. She claimed that using a single email account rather than following the recommended policy of sending official communications through a State Department email address spared her the chore of having to carry two smartphones, one for private emails and the other for official emails. It was a transparently phony excuse for keeping her emails out of the public record. Anyone can run two email accounts from one device. Even Democrats had to cringe at her startling admission she'd unilaterally deleted 31,830 personal emails sent during her tenure as secretary, while turning over 55,000 pages of screened official emails. Clinton's scrubbing of the record can only leave voters wondering what she was hiding, said Charles Lipson in RealClearPolitics.com. Now Republican Representative Trey Gowdy, leading the House investigation into the Benghazi attack, has demanded that the Clintons' private server be turned over for analysis. Suddenly, the Democrats' only viable candidate for 2016 is in free fall. Let's keep things in perspective, said Danny Vinnick in NewRepublic.com. Clinton's email practices, while unorthodox, didn't violate any law. And while she may be having a tough month, she is so far ahead of every Democrat in the polls and in fundraising that she can withstand a temporary hit like this. If anything, the email flap may serve as a wake-up call to Clinton and her advisors, letting them know that the 2016 campaign is already underway. Still, some Democrats are quietly wondering if they need to start looking for an alternate candidate, said Emma Roller in NationalJournal.com. But the pickings are slim. Clinton's only likely rival so far, former U.S. Senator Jim Webb of Virginia and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley, can't begin to match her star power and enormous fundraising advantage. Progressive darling Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts insists she isn't running, and the window for other Democrats to jump into the race is quickly closing. I have little doubt Hillary will survive this mess, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. If there's a damning email out there, it's been deleted. And the relevant hard drive would be harder to find than Jimmy Hoffa's body. What Clinton can't erase, however, is the reminder of her Nixonian paranoia and penchant for flouting legal norms. Democrats have now been warned what's coming if they nominate their inevitable candidate. At some point down the tracks, when yet another fetid cloud of Clintonism erupts into plain view, many smart liberals will look back at this moment as the time when they should have pulled the emergency brake and gotten off the Hillary train. Even as a longtime liberal fan of Hillary, I have to admit it. I quietly dread her campaign and her presidency, said Josh Marshall in TalkingPointsMemo.com. Yes, her enemies are hyping the email mess, just as they did Whitewater, the Lewinsky investigation, Benghazi, and other phony scandals. But the one thing the Clintons always bring is drama. Always. Wild allegations, legalistic defenses, and plot twist worthy of a soap opera have followed the Clintons through their decades in public life and are just inseparable from who they are. Here we go again. Well, it was a good week for looking up after a 27-year-old Florida woman had a miraculous escape after walking into the path of an oncoming freight train while texting. Sheena Kana broke an arm but survived. It was a good week for irony after Alaska's annual Iditarod dog sled race had to be moved northward due to a lack of snow. If one more person says to me to move the Iditarod to Boston, said race director Mark Nordman, I'm going to shake my head. It was a good week for holiday cheer after a radio station in Albany, New York, announced that it would play Christmas music all year long. This might strike some as being a risky move, said a spokesman for Santa 105.7 FM. But there's literally a clamoring for Christmas music 24/7, 365. It was a bad week for hearty breakfast after an Australian man discovered a nearly 7-foot python curled up inside a cereal box. I peeked in the box, saw its head pop out, said Jared Smith. That's when I dropped my food on the counter and bolted for the door. It was a bad week for graphic occupations after a technical error resulted in a Romanian diplomatic brochure depicting France covered with the colors of the German flag. Romania's foreign minister expressed profound regret to all offended parties. And it was a bad week for speeding while rich after a millionaire motorist in Finland, where traffic fines are scaled to income, had to pay a nearly $60,000 fine for driving 64 miles per hour in a 50-mile-per-hour zone. Finland is impossible to live in, the driver said, for certain kinds of people. And on the briefing page, the quest for the perfect diet. A spate of recent studies has upended decades of established dietary advice about eating fat. Is fat now good? What should we eat? Mostly vegetables. Veggies of all kinds and colors, including salads and other leafy greens, are loaded with various types of phytonutrients and antioxidants that are essential to healthy living. Many recent studies have shown that people who eat more vegetables and other plant-based foods, such as beans, whole grains, fruits, and nuts, tend to have lower rates of heart disease and other chronic health issues than those who mainly consume animal-based products like meat and cheese. But researchers have also recently discovered that fat, maligned for more than 40 years as the leading cause of weight gain and high cholesterol, can also be part of a healthy diet. Americans were told to cut back on fat to lose weight and prevent heart disease, said Dr. David Ludwig, an obesity specialist at Boston Children's Hospital. Today, there's an overwhelmingly strong case to be made for the opposite. Can fat really be good for us? Yes, but not all fats are created equal. Foods like beans, nuts, and fish, which are rich in monounsaturated and polyunsaturated fats, are strongly linked to good cardiovascular health. But several recent studies found that even the saturated fats in red meat, butter, and cheese can be consumed in moderation, and that foods high in cholesterol do not raise cholesterol levels in most people. Those findings run counter to decades-old dietary guidelines from the American Heart Association and the U.S. government, which stated that people should avoid saturated fats because they clog our arteries, causing heart attacks and strokes. How did we get it so wrong? Blame bad science. In 1970, a University of Minnesota physiologist named Ansel Keys published his landmark Seven Countries Study, which examined diets across Europe, the U.S., and Asia. He concluded that people who ate a lot of meat and dairy, like Finnish lumberjacks, died from heart attacks at far higher rates than farmers in Crete, whose fish, fruit, and grain-heavy diet was lower in saturated fats. Critics noted many mistakes in Key's study. He looked at the Cretan diet during Lent, when the islanders had given up meat and cheese. But his conclusions were widely accepted because they seemed to make sense. After all, saturated fats are known to raise LDL, or bad cholesterol, and higher levels of LDL are a leading indicator of heart disease. But now there is increasing evidence that the type of LDL particles associated with saturated fats, known as pattern A, are not harmful. The argument against fat was totally and completely flawed, said Dr. Robert Lustig, president of the San Francisco-based Institute for Responsible Nutrition. What effect did Key's study have? In 1980, the federal government issued its first set of dietary guidelines, telling everyone over age 2 to avoid fat. America's didn't get any healthier. Adult obesity rates nearly tripled over the next 3 decades to 35%, while adolescent obesity rates quadrupled. The U.S. now spends $190 billion a year treating obesity-related conditions. The government-backed campaign against fat backfired in part because Americans replaced the calories they got from milk and cheese with calories from refined carbohydrates like white bread and pasta. Carbs turn into sugar in the bloodstream, which increases insulin production and encourages cells to store fat instead of burning it. With less energy available to fuel the body, the metabolism slows down, hunger sets in, and the process repeats itself. Does that mean carbs are the real problem? The case against them is strong, but if the low-fat era has proved anything, it's that focusing on just one aspect of a person's diet can have unintended consequences. Human physiology is simply too complex for the effects of an individual foodstuff or nutrient to be isolated and properly understood. We should not be singling out particular components in food and vilifying them, said Catherine Collins, head dietitian at St. George's Hospital in London. We should be promoting a balanced diet with a lot of variety, including some lean meat, fish, whole grain cereals, fruit and vegetables, even a little wine if you like. Essentially, it's the Mediterranean diet. Is that the ideal diet? Possibly, but we can't be 100% sure because almost all dietary studies are observational and so have a fundamental limitation. Scientists will monitor the eating habits of test groups for years or even decades and then draw associations between the subject's diet and the diseases they suffer. Such an observational study might show that individuals who eat more vegetables tend to live longer, but it can't prove causation, that eating more veggies is the reason for that longer lifespan. Many nutritionists say their best advice is for people to stop obsessing over individual aspects of a particular diet and focus instead on choosing naturally processed foods and avoiding processed foods that are loaded with additives and excess sugar. If you eat direct from nature, nutrients tend to take care of themselves, said Dr. David Katz, director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center. The cold, hard truth is the only way to eat well is to eat well. Take a look now at our columns. First comes from the U.S. Stephen Moore at the Washington Times. Right to work means the right to choose. Scott Walker has put big labor in an understandable panic, said Stephen Moore. Wisconsin's Republican governor this week signed a bill banning private sector unions from requiring all employees at a unionized firm to pay dues, making Wisconsin the 25th state in the nation to pass right-to-work legislation. History shows that when workers aren't forced to pay union dues and fees, they usually choose not to. When Wisconsin blocked unions from automatically collecting dues from government employees in 2011, some unions saw a decline of 80% of worker payments. Big Labor argues that making membership optional restricts unions' collective bargaining power and allows employees to benefit from unions' work without paying for it. But if unions are such a boon for workers, why must they force people to join? Many skilled workers justifiably believe they're hamstrung by a one-size-fits-all union contract. Others don't want to bankroll the bloated salaries of union bosses or pay for their left-wing partisan political activities. So let's hope other states follow Wisconsin's example and give American workers what liberals used to say they were in favor of, the right to choose. From Canada, Elizabeth Renzetti at the Globe and Mail. Where winter can be a jail sentence. Thousands of innocent Canadians have been condemned to the misery of solitary confinement, said Elizabeth Renzetti. The jailer who put them there is, of course, this unspeakable winter. Living here this season has been the equivalent of being trapped in an ice palace. Nova Scotia is buried under so much snow that its police actually put out a warrant for the arrest of Old Man Winter. And you can be sure they were only partly joking. Toronto weathered its coldest February on record, and many old and disabled people spent the whole month indoors. The ice and snow can be lethal for those with mobility issues. Wheelchair user Mark Strohs was dropped off by a cab outside his Toronto home one night last month, only to be found dead, face down in the snow, the next morning. Elderly Toronto residents who know that a fall could mean a broken hip and a drawn-out death are simply staying indoors. Yet the effects of such enforced isolation are excruciating. People who are shut in for months are at risk of all kinds of health problems, including muscle atrophy and depression. We know better weather will come eventually, perhaps by mid-June, but how many Canadians will have lost their sanity by then? From Jordan, Jihad Al-Mansi at Al-Gad asks, what are America's ties to ISIS? Does anyone believe the U.S. when it claims to be shocked by the rise of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria? Asked Jihad al-Mansi. The Americans were able to blockade Iraq thoroughly ahead of the first Gulf War and for years afterward. Not even a bird was allowed in without permission. And that was long before the U.S. developed its fleet of drones, which now crisscross the Middle East skies, watching everything. So why doesn't the U.S. know how the Islamic State and other groups are funded? Are their drones for some reason uniquely incapable of monitoring ISIS members? We know that some U.S. aid and weaponry intended for the Kurds have ended up in ISIS hands. The U.S. must have some role, overt or covert, in supplying these bloody organizations with human resources, money, and weapons. Do I sound paranoid? Recall that under President Reagan, the U.S. armed, trained, and funded the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who later became the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Even now, the U.S. seems content with verbal condemnation of ISIS atrocities, doing little militarily to stop the group. The U.S. knows how ISIS developed, who funded it, who supported it, and who opened borders to it. America is hiding the truth. Why? And our in-depth article this week, The Last Word, is titled, The Descent to Earth. Cheryl Stearns is the greatest female skydiver in history, said Michael Graff, but she may never jump again. On November 12, 2014, a warm Wednesday with one of those storybook Carolina blue skies, the greatest female skydiver in history lay unconscious on a patch of hard blacktop just west of Charlotte. Her head, nose, elbow, and mouth were cut open. Her glasses were smashed, and she was bleeding inside her skull. The only witness told police she couldn't tell who was at fault. In the weeks leading up to the accident, Cheryl Stearns had been making a final push to an unfathomable record, 20,000 career skydives. Only a handful of men before her have reached that number. She was to be the first woman. She was preparing for a skydiving competition in Dubai, scheduled for just after Thanksgiving. For most people who jump out of a plane, landing safely is the only important thing. But Stearns is an accuracy skydiver, so when she lands, she scored on how close to the heel of her right shoe lands to a nickel-sized dot on a mat. She won her first World Skydiving Championship in 1978, by landing on the exact same spot in a field in Yugoslavia 18 consecutive times. Few people on the planet are as precise as Stearns. She spent 15 years in the Army and was the first female member of the elite parachuting team, the Golden Knights. She's jumped out of a plane in 35 countries and 32 states. She's won 30 women's national skydiving championships, 5 world military championships, and 2 overall world championships. And in November 1995, she jumped 352 times in a single day, setting a world record that still stands for jumps in a 24-hour period by a woman. She once jumped out over New York Harbor and curled around the crown of the Statue of Liberty with smoke streaming out of canisters on her shoes and an American flag tied to her back, landing in front of hundreds of people. Another time, she steered her parachute underneath the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. She's revered in the aviation community. But at 59, even Stearns know that she'll come down someday. She may not have a 30,000th jump or a 25,000th jump. This might be her last big round number. She wanted 20,000 to be special. She wanted it to happen in Dubai and on the winning jump. So she spaced out her training in October and early November. She'd get 3 or 4 practice jumps in Dubai, she knew, and then 10 competition jumps. A skydiving accuracy competition is like golf. The lowest score wins. On each landing, a sensor measures the jumper's distance from the target. 1 centimeter off target, equals 1 point. 2 centimeters equals 2, and so forth. The points are added together after 10 jumps. The best score is 0. What I really hope happens is that I get to 20,000 with a dead center to win the meet, Stearns told me the Saturday before the accident. In order to make that happen, she needed to schedule her training so that her last practice jump onto Carolina soil was number 19,986. After the accident, doctors at the Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte put 8 staples in her head and stitches in her arm. She refused painkillers. Miraculously, nothing was broken, but she'd suffered what doctors said was a moderate traumatic brain injury. In her day job, Stearns is an on-call pilot for U.S. Airways. If the airline needs someone to fly, her phone will ring, and she'll pick up her travel bag and drive 8 minutes from her home to Charlotte Douglas International Airport. She has more than 21,000 flying hours without incident. On her off days, she drives to Shelby to fly her private plane, a Cessna, which she uses as a member of the Civil Air Patrol. In the few moments of her life that she's not flying, she bikes or goes on hikes. Her standard ride is a 25-mile route past a lake that takes 2 hours and 15 minutes exactly. When she awoke in the emergency room, her longtime friend and roommate, Lindy Leach, was there. Stearns told Leach she couldn't remember anything. That night, she caught brief blinks of sleep in between the throbbing headaches. The next morning, she tried to call home to tell Leach she was being moved out of intensive care, but she couldn't remember her home number. Every now and then, if we're lucky, we come across a force in life, a person, a job, a moment, that changes the course of everything. Skydiving walloped Cheryl Stearns. To a skydiver, free fall is peace. The 120 miles per hour winds notwithstanding, up there is one of the only truly quiet places humans can go anymore. If you add together all of her skydives, Stearns has been in that quiet state of free fall for 5 days, 13 hours and 35 minutes of her life. She's recorded every jump in 125 parachuting logbooks, which she keeps piled in a plastic bin in her attic. The early pages are crowded with dangerous encounters. After her 38th jump, at age 17, she was standing on the ground while a pilot buzzed the field. He swooped too low, clipped a telephone pole, and flipped over. While Stearns ran to escape the flying splinters and falling hot wires, the plane pancaked on the ground, cockpit down, killing the pilot. A dozen jumps later, she watched 2 experienced skydivers collide in free fall, knocking each other unconscious. They never opened their chutes. On jump 56, May 6, 1973, she had her first malfunction. Her main parachute didn't open. She cut away or released the faulty main. Back then, the reserve chute was on the diver's belly. She should have flipped over with her back facing the ground before pulling, but fear can disable reason, and she forgot. The reserve fired straight between her legs. Only luck kept the lines from ripping her foot off or tangling with each other. When the chute opened, it yanked her into a forward somersault in the sky, and she landed safely. When she had her second malfunction a few months later on jump 166, she was determined to deploy her reserve the correct way. She flipped over, secured the ripcord, and tossed it. But she'd taken too long. The chute snatched her by the stomach, and her back arched violently. By the time she turned around to look for the ground, she was only 300 feet up. If she'd waited 2 seconds longer, she'd have been dead. After she landed, Stearns sat on the ground sobbing. Later that day, she made her 167th jump. "If I didn't get back up that day," she says now, "I knew I never would." In November 1995, Stearns wanted to set a new world record for parachute jumps in 24 hours. Skydiving friends arranged a rotation of 10 people to help pack her parachutes, one after the other, so that she could land, grab one, and get back into the sky. She logged every jump over the 24 hours in her books, writing down the exact second of landing. The first occurred at 5:28:55 p.m. on November 8th, and she stuck number 352 at 5:25:18 on November 9th. The longest stretch between landings was 9 minutes and 22 seconds, and that was for what's simply recorded in her books as a bathroom break. The shortest break between landings was 2 minutes and 54 seconds. The rest mostly ranged from 3 to 4 minutes. By the last hour, to help her conserve energy, her friends were catching her just after she landed, scooping her up by the legs, and carrying her to the plane. She outlasted most of her help. When it was over, she'd covered 704,000 feet of sky and had spent 29 minutes and 33 seconds of her 24 hours in free fall. She'd also added another degree of difficulty. She'd secured a new world record with 188 dead center landings in 24 hours. Just before 1 p.m. on that blue-skied Wednesday last fall, Stearns rolled her mountain bike out of her garage and went off down a route she knows by heart. She was thinking about Dubai. She was thinking about the new jumping shoes she'd purchased. 25 miles, 2 hours and 15 minutes. As she approached an intersection, the bike lane ran out. Stearns hugged the right shoulder. A police report lists various accounts of what happened next. A witness says Stearns was on the white line, but in the lane. Stearns believes she was over far enough. The driver of a 2010 Nissan struck Stearns on the left side of her back at 30 miles per hour. Stearns doesn't know when she was knocked out, but she was. Today her head, doctors tell her, can't handle abrupt changes in altitude. The most accomplished skydiver in the world is grounded. Even sneezing hurts, she said. Federal Aviation Administration guidelines dictate that a pilot who has had a concussion can't fly for at least 6 months and must go back through a flying school before returning to the cockpit. Stearns' concussion was so severe, she's already been ruled out for a year. A neurologist initially told Stearns it would be 6 to 8 weeks before she could even ride in an airplane again, let alone jump out. In the best-case scenario, they told her the earliest she could skydive again would be April. "I guess there's a chance it's forever," she told me in December. "I can't have that, though. I don't know what I'll do if I can't go up." On the morning of her last skydive, Stearns flew a Charlotte to Philadelphia round trip before packing up her car with skydiving gear. There was no wind that day, but with the new shoes, she struggled to land on the tiny target. Each time, her heel touched a centimeter or two to the right or left. In competition, a centimeter equals a point. Skydivers often call them pennies. "Son of a blank," Stearns shouted after a two-point landing on jump 19,983. "Man, I haven't gotten a dead center yet today," she said while recording 19,984. "One penny," she shook her head while writing down 19,985. As the sun began to fade, Stearns went up one more time for jump 19,986. At 3,000 feet, she jumped and did a backflip in the air for fun. Then she thrust her pelvis out toward the ground, giving her the pose that, under any circumstance, will take a flailing, falling human and put her face down toward the earth. She fell for a few more seconds and pulled the chute. Stearns fell toward the ground slowly, pulling two toggles to steer in the breezeless air. At 400 feet, she turned for home. At 200 feet, she was right on the line. She had been doing this for 42 years, over and over, nearly 20,000 times, and not once had Cheryl Stearns given any thought to the idea that this jump might be her last. She smiled as she came down. Her heel dug into the sensor. The landing for jump 19,986 was perfect. The electronic scoreboard beeped and showed her score. She pulled herself up from the mat to look. "Ah," she said, "that had better be a zero." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Charlotte magazine. Have an obituary for you this week. The NBA player who broke the color barrier. Earl Lloyd, 1928 to 2015. In many ways, Earl Lloyd's NBA debut for the Washington Capitals in 1950 was unremarkable. The 6'6" forward scored only 6 points in a humdrum loss to the Rochester Royals in front of just 2,184 fans. But while Lloyd's performance was nothing special, his appearance was historic. It made him the first black player to play in an NBA game. Others joined him not long after. The Boston Celtics fielded African-American forward Chuck Cooper in their own season opener 24 hours later. "I'm the answer to a trivia question," said Lloyd. "Through a scheduling quirk, I beat Chuck Cooper by a day." Lloyd was born and raised in a segregated Alexandria, Virginia, and had never sat next to a white person before he was 21, said the Washington Post. But after being drafted by the Capitals, he was quickly accepted by his white teammates, many of whom were from northern cities and had played with African Americans in high school and college. Because basketball was a relatively minor sport at the time, Lloyd's NBA debut drew little attention in the press, said the Los Angeles Times. But throughout his 9-season playing career with the Capitals, the Syracuse Nationals, and the Detroit Pistons, Lloyd faced racial challenges on and off the court. He often had to eat at different restaurants and stay at different hotels from his teammates. In Fort Wayne, Indiana, fans spat on him and told him to go back to Africa. Lloyd said that the racist taunts didn't bother him. "It gives you a little added incentive," he explained. "The more names they called me, the harder I played." In 1971, Lloyd took charge of the Pistons, becoming the fourth black head coach in NBA history, said the New York Times. He was fired early the next season following a string of defeats and went on to work as an executive at Chrysler's Dodge division and later for the Detroit Board of Education. Always modest, Lloyd never boasted about becoming the NBA's first black player. "I didn't play it up or down," he said. "I just hope I conducted myself where I made it easier for others. And I think I did." On the Health and Science page, uncovering an ancient lost city. For centuries, explorers and treasure hunters have searched in vain for the White City, the legendary home of a long-lost Central American civilization. Now, American and Honduran researchers think they've finally found the pre-Columbian settlement, deep in the Honduran rainforests. The ruins of La Ciudad Blanca were first identified in 2012 by an aerial survey that used ground-penetrating radar to peer beneath the jungle canopy. When the team of archaeologists trekked into the rainforest to investigate, they found the remains of a once-thriving metropolis, with an array of plazas, earthworks, and possible irrigation canals and reservoirs, dating back to between AD 1000 and 1400. Among the most exciting discoveries was a cache of 52 pristine stone sculptures partially buried at the base of an earthen pyramid. Archaeologists know almost nothing about the culture that once flourished in the White City. They don't have a name for those ancient people or a reason why they disappeared. Since the artifacts have yet to be excavated, the settlement's exact location has not been revealed. This is clearly the most undisturbed rainforest in Central America, the expedition's ethnobotanist Mark Plotkin tells NationalGeographic.com. The importance of this place can't be overestimated. Coffee may curb heart attacks. Coffee has a bad reputation when it comes to heart health, but new research suggests that drinking up to 5 cups of this stuff a day could actually reduce the risk of a heart attack. Scientists in South Korea studied the link between coffee consumption and coronary artery calcium levels, an early indicator of cardiovascular disease, the clogging of arteries with fatty substances, which can lead to heart attacks. Researchers examined 25,000 men and women and found calcium levels were lowest in people who drank 3 to 5 cups a day. The next lowest level belonged to people who drank 1 to 2 cups a day. But the scientists found that excessive coffee consumption was worse than drinking no Joe at all. Calcium levels were highest in test subjects who drank more than 5 cups daily. Researchers still aren't sure why imbibing a moderate amount of coffee is good for your heart. It could be that powerful antioxidants in the beverage help reduce the risk of disease. But whatever the explanation, the findings are good news for Java fans. We are not ready to say people should drink more coffee, Dr. Eliseo Gualar of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health tells Newsweek. But if you do drink it, you shouldn't worry. The panda's giant comeback. The endangered giant panda is making a comeback thanks to a huge conservation effort. There are now 1,864 of the iconic animals in the wild in China, according to a government census, up 17% since 2003. Giant pandas have been helped by Beijing's creation of large nature reserves in the animal's traditional habitat, the bamboo-covered mountain slopes of southwest China, and by a crackdown on illegal logging and poaching. But the future of the beloved black and white bear is still far from certain. Their bamboo fields are increasingly dissected by roads, making it difficult for the solitary animals to roam and find mates. Plans to build hydroelectric dams in the steep river valleys of the southwest China also threaten the survival of the giant panda in the wild. The pressure is on China. The whole world is watching, British zoologist Jules Howard tells The Independent. This is showpiece conservation for them. And to the Talking Points page, Flight 370, an ongoing mystery. A year after Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 vanished from the skies, an independent report has detailed exactly what's known about the missing plane, said Matt Shivenza in TheAtlantic.com. Its conclusion? Not much. All the 584-page document reveals is that the battery in the aircraft's black box locator beacon expired more than a year before Flight 370 took off, that the initial search was hampered by incompetence and miscommunications, and that neither of the plane's pilots was suicidal. For now, the fate of the Red Eye from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing and its 239 passengers and crew remains one of the greatest mysteries in aviation history. The consensus view is that Flight 370 is at the bottom of the southern Indian Ocean, said Sean Flynn in GQ. Radar and satellite data showed the Boeing 777 heading north after takeoff before leaving its flight path and veering south. The plane flew on for 6 hours after its last sighting on Malaysian military radar. Salvage ships are expected to finish searching the 23,000 square mile area of the Indian Ocean in May. If nothing is found by then, the $94 million search operation will likely be scaled back. The crux of the mystery is why MH370 ended up wherever it did, said Clive Irving in thedailybeast.com. Most experts agree the plane was on autopilot after either a mechanical issue or failed hijacking attempt incapacitated the flight crew. Some blame a cargo consignment of combustible lithium-ion batteries. Ultimately, though, trying to establish what happened without the wreckage is like trying to solve a murder without the body. It's essential to find Flight 370, said Justin Green in CNN.com, not just to provide much-needed closure for the victims' families, but also to improve aviation safety. If the problem was mechanical, other planes could be at risk. If hijackers were responsible, security needs to be tightened. There is another reason we want to see the mystery solved, said Ted Anthony in the Associated Press. The wonders of modern GPS location technology, built into our smartphones and satellite navigation systems, have convinced many of us that we have, through gadgetry, rendered the world finite. Flight 370 reminds us that the planet remains a forbidding place, and there are still, and perhaps always will be, places to disappear. Another Talking Points article. America, is our democracy doomed? Not to alarm anyone, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. But our democracy is going to collapse. That may sound like a typical overreaction to the gridlock and partisanship of the Obama era, but the present dysfunction in Washington is actually a known defect of presidential democracies, and often an omen of looming catastrophe. In nations with parliamentary systems, citizens vote for local representatives, who then consent to be led by prime minister. But in the U.S., both President and Congress are elected directly, giving both a valid claim to speak for the people. The Constitution provides no real mechanism for resolving disputes between the two, so it's usually only the unwritten norms of civility and protocol that keep chaos at bay. If those norms stop being observed and both sides play constitutional hardball, the president repeatedly uses executive orders to bypass Congress, for instance, and Congress interferes with the president's foreign policy, the whole system can quickly disintegrate. One can only hope that it won't be violent. If our system of government implodes, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com, it'll be the fault of the GOP-led Congress. Never before has one of our two main parties embraced a policy of total opposition to a president, blocking everything he tries to do, even measures it previously supported. You obviously don't understand how democracy works, said Carl Eric Scott in NationalReview.com. Republicans oppose Obama because they don't share his agenda. That's what an opposition party does. The uniquely dangerous threat to our system today is Obama's attempt to circumvent Congress and govern as an elected monarch. The defects in our system are real, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com, and could push us deeper into true presidential democracy, in which every president wields the expansive powers that Obama's now claiming. But that wouldn't necessarily be a disaster, so long as the presidency's powers seem within reach to both coalitions every 4 years. It's a system both parties could probably live with. I'm guessing our democracy will muddle through, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. Our leaders will occasionally unite to pass legislation, but many complex problems, like our bloated tax code and crumbling infrastructure, will go unaddressed. The cost of our democratic dysfunction won't be a spectacular collapse. It will be the slow divergence between what our living standards could be and what they are. and some shorter notes. Anti-U.S. sentiment in Russia is now at its highest level since pollsters began tracking it in 1988. More than 80% of Russians hold negative views of the United States, a figure that has more than doubled in the past year alone, thanks to the fury over U.S. sanctions and the war in Ukraine. U.S. pizza companies spent $1.5 million on political contributions in the 2012 and 2014 elections, with 88% of the money going to Republicans. The agenda of the American pizza community, the industry's lobbying group, includes fighting mandatory menu labeling laws and keeping pizza classified as a vegetable by the USDA for school lunches. Among the 19 cities that have hosted the Winter Olympics, including Calgary, Alberta, Chamois, France, Nagano, Japan, and Oslo, the average February temperature has increased from 32 in the 1920s to 46 degrees today. Airline accidents killed 641 people last year, according to the International Air Transport Association, up from 2010 and 2013, even though the number of fatal crashes fell from 16 to 12. The figures don't include the 298 people killed when Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over the Ukraine, because the disaster was not classified as an accident. On the poll watch, 27% of Americans think Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email account for government business while she was Secretary of State is a very serious problem, including 44% of Republicans and 17% of Democrats. 42% say it's not a serious problem. And a quote for you to finish off the hour from Emily Dickinson. It is easy to work when the soul is at play. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.